Hello there, and thank you for joining us today on this Wednesday, October the 2nd. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, an ominous request to Congress from a government watchdog relating to the Ukraine investigation.
It raises a lot of speculation as to why he is making this urgent request right now.
Protests in Hong Kong turn bloody and violent as police shoot a young demonstrator in the chest. Also ahead, a beloved international opera singer's passing and the amazing start of her career. The Trump administration remains defiant toward Congress. On Tuesday, it took a defiant step toward resisting the impeachment inquiry as Secretary of State Mike Pompeo would not allow congressional committees access to witnesses and documents. Democrats are warning that the efforts could amount to an impeachable offense on its own. The escalating exchange of accusations and warnings signaled yet another stiffening in the confrontation between the executive and legislative branches amid the Democrats' launching of the impeachment inquiry late last week. This, as the State Department Inspector General has now requested an urgent hearing in Congress. Joining us now to talk about that is Mark Rosell, Dean of the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. How unusual is something like this for an inspector general to urgently want a hearing with Congress?
This is a very unusual request. I don't know of any past action similar to this. And it raises a lot of speculation as to why he is making this urgent request right now. We can certainly speculate as to whether it has something to do, for example, with the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, trying to hold back some people from the State Department testifying before congressional committees, suggesting that some employees of his department are somehow being bullied into having to cooperate with the inquiry. The Inspector General certainly wants to make sure that all procedures are properly followed. So I could imagine that he would be calling this meeting in part to establish what he considers to be some appropriate ground rules for the inclusion of members of the State Department testifying before Congress and how much they can tell and what the limits may be on what they may be able to testify about.
Tell us exactly what an inspector general's job is. And
inspector general is supposed to be completely nonpartisan. Their role is to ensure that rules and procedures are followed, that there is accountability in the system, that the actions of employees within a department or agency comport with various federal rules and guidelines, and to present reports when there have been allegations, for example, of wrongdoing, as to what the findings are based on the facts. So this is part of the accountability system in the United States government that ensures that employees of the executive branch are following rules and procedures properly and that there are no abuses of the system.
If the Secretary of State is blocking State Department staffers from testifying or coming before Congress, what if they do it anyway? Or is that just unheard of?
Well, it's not entirely unheard of. So there is a question whether these people have, in a sense, a dual loyalty, right, that they serve in the State Department under the Secretary of State, but at the same time, they have a responsibility to be accountable to the legislative branch, you know, which authorizes and funds executive branch departments and agencies. So typically, a congressional call to testify when there are allegations of wrongdoing in the executive branch is a very compelling request and one not to be taken lightly. I could imagine even some of these officials who may have direct knowledge events surrounding this latest controversy being threatened with contempt citations if they refuse to testify.
Does the same apply to the Secretary of State for defying or being defiant about giving Congress what it's requesting and by law has a right to request?
Well, the Secretary of State is accountable to the legislative branch. You know, he is a senatorial approved official, you know, who is expected to appear before Congress if Congress has questions about the operations of the State Department. And it is the legislative branch that holds the executive branch, Department departments and agencies accountable. So one would think that he really should testify if called to do so. I imagine that there may be an attempt by the president to stop the Secretary of State from testifying, perhaps even a claim of executive privilege, a legal principle that presidents sometimes claim to prevent testimony or disclosure of documents and other information to Congress. And that's going to be very tricky because that could end up in a protracted legal battle, certainly. But I would argue that the Secretary of State should appear before Congress, should tell what he knows. There are allegations, serious ones of wrongdoing. He has direct knowledge, apparently, based on having been a party to hearing conversations between the United States president and the Ukrainian leader. He would certainly have direct knowledge of information that Congress seeks in order to get the facts regarding whether there were actual violations of constitutional principles by the president.
All right. We appreciate your perspective. That's Mark Rozell. He is the dean of the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Well, a major part of Democrats and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's arguing about impeachment, saying the national security was a big part of the decision to conduct the impeachment inquiry. For that part of the story, we are joined by Jamil Jaffer, founder and president of the National Security Institute. How big of a national security, what sorts of things would constitute national security threat within the accusations against the conversation the president had with Ukraine's president?
Well, certainly if foreign leaders think that they're hearing something from the president that could subject him to concerns at home, or the president saying things that could cause him trouble at home, that puts the foreign leaders in an unusual position of having sort of leverage. That can obviously be concern. That's an area where Congress and you know, the American people can be legitimately concerned if foreign leaders think they have leverage over the president. Now, in this case, for example, clearly the president, you know, wasn't giving any leverage to the Ukrainian president because he's now released the transcripts. But who knows what happens with other conversations? There's certainly a potential if things that are inappropriate or that would be embarrassing or problematic were to come out and a foreign leader knows that, then that gives them leverage to say, look, do me this favor and I won't release this information about you. Now, you know, President Trump is taking the position that, you know, none of this stuff matters and that none of the things he did was inappropriate. And so in that case, if that's his view, that won't give anybody leverage over him. But any time a foreign leader might have leverage or a foreign government might have leverage is an opportunity for concern, particularly when it comes to national security matters.
What about if the opposite is happening, where the leaders in the United States, the administration, are basically asking for favors and the whatever country that may be needs something from the U.S., so they feel obliged to just go along with the request?
Well, look, I mean, the United States, like every other country in the world, regularly uses things that it wants and things that other people need sort of as an exchange of value, right? That's not an unusual thing, whether it's, you know, the Louisiana Purchase, and that was an exchange of land for money, or a agreement to lift sanctions in exchange for ceasing a nuclear program, like happened in the Obama administration. You know, what countries want, what two nation states want, are oftentimes the subject of negotiations. There's nothing wrong with that. I think the concern that people have here is the question whether the president was trading something of value to Ukraine for personal gain or political gain, and that's, I think, where people are concerned. It's not unusual at all for people to use what another nation wants as leverage. That's just international relations. And so the question here is, did this cross a line? Was there a sort of a suggestion that I will do you this favor if you do me this favor? Is that what was going on here? So I really understand that we have this one transcript and we have sort of the notes of that transcript, knowing more about what was said in that conversation, know what was said in the lead up to other conversations around it. I mean, whether this is a pattern of behavior in other conversations that might be taking place with other foreign leaders, I think that's what Congress is going to try to look at. Mm-hmm. Whether they'll get access that information or not is a much harder question, and one that has a long history of fights between Congress and the presidency in terms of getting access to executive communications with foreign leaders.
All right. That is Jamil Jaffer. He's the founder and president of the National Security Institute. Thanks for being with us. The U.S. reached its self-imposed cap of 30,000 refugee arrivals Monday, which was the last of the 2019 fiscal year. But the Trump administration is now looking at another major reduction in refugee admittance for 2020. State Department last week announced it's seeking to resettle only 18,000 refugees in the fiscal year, which would be the lowest in the U.S. since the modern refugee program that was approved by Congress in 1980. The refugees referred for settlement are those the U.N. has identified as unable to remain safely in their home country or in the country where they fled, people for which resettlement is really a last resort. Joining us now to talk more about the decision by the Trump administration is Eric Schwartz, president of the Refugees International. Thanks for being with us. How does this compare to numbers of refugees under previous administrations?
Year of the Obama administration, the president announced a ceiling of 110,000. That would have been for fiscal year 2017.
And since then, has it been slowly reduced?
Not slowly, dramatically, by the administration of Donald Trump.
What is their reasoning and rationale for this?
They variously express concerns about security. Most recently, they've expressed concerns about the need to handle asylum cases at the border. But that's all nonsense. This is an administration that is virulently anti-immigrant, that has trafficked in xenophobia and has sought to use the issue of immigration and refugees to rev up, excite its political base in ways that have been extremely damaging to the well-being and interests of both asylum seekers and refugees. We refer to refugees as people who come into the United States through the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program, people chosen by the United States who are generally in countries of asylum, whereas we refer to asylum seekers as people who are either in the United States or at the U.S. border and are seeking entry, essentially as refugees as well. But the program we're talking about now is really the first program, the Refugee Program.
Experts know that the refugee crisis is likely to just continue to get worse with climate change. Where do people go?
Refugee resettlement in the way that it is affected by the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program will only be a solution for a small minority of the world's refugees under any circumstances. There are over 25 million refugees around the world, and refugee resettlement is only one durable solution. The others are return to the country of origin when conditions that cause the refugee to flee are resolved and there is no fear of persecution upon return, or the refugee where he or she has fled is given more permanent refuge or the opportunity to integrate into the population of the country to which the refugee has fled. But the third durable solution is the solution of third country resettlement, and although that's never going to be a solution for the majority of the world's refugees, for particularly vulnerable cases, cases where people have been temporary refuge for decades, people who have experienced, for example, severe trauma, refugee resettlement is an important, although limited, option. And if the United States of America decides that they're going to go from 110,000 down to 18,000, sends two terrible signals. The first is to the countries around the world that are hosting hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of refugees. The countries like Jordan, like Turkey, like Uganda, Ethiopia, countries that are bearing, you know, really significant and substantial burdens, the United States of America should be sending a signal of solidarity to those countries. The second terrible message that this sends is it communicates to other resettlement countries that they don't have to do very much. There are countries around the world that also resettle refugees, and the United States has historically been the leader in the refugee resettlement effort. So if we are dramatically reducing our refugee resettlement numbers, then other countries who have resettlement programs have less incentive to do more. So this is a very disappointing decision.
Could you equate 18,000, the number of people that will be allowed in, to a visual? Would that be the size of how many people are in, say, a football stadium?
Oh, it's far less than in a football stadium. I mean, you know, if you go to Penn State University, that's a big football stadium. You could put five or six times that number in the football stadium itself. 18,000 would be the size of a reasonably large basketball arena. To comparison, tens of thousands of Venezuelans are pouring into Colombia every day, but in terms of the numbers who come in who stay for some period of time, you know, that's about anywhere between 3,000 and 5,000 a day. So you multiply that by 4 days, you get to your 18,000. And so the United States, the richest country on earth, that has had a very positive experience with refugee resettlement, that we say, that this president says, that we can only absorb in 1 year the number of asylum seekers that the government of Colombia absorbs in 4 days, is kind of pathetic.
I know that Congress needs to be consulted. It doesn't sound like it's a vote. What is your organization doing?
This is an area where the president has pretty complete authority. The only thing I would say to the rest of the world is this president does not reflect the views, the perspectives, the values of the American people on this issue. All of his predecessors, Republican predecessors, Democratic predecessors, have warmly embraced the U.S. refugee admissions program. This is not what America should stand for, and I believe this president is acting in conflict with the values that most Americans hold.
All right. Well, that is Eric Schwartz, president of the Refugees International. Meanwhile, a UN High Commissioner for Refugee spokesman is telling VOA that the refugee agency is following reports of possible forcible deportation of Burundian refugees from Tanzania. The UNHCR spokesman said it's not safe to send refugees back to Burundi, where their lives are at risk. There are more than 340,000 Burundian refugees. 200,000 of them are in Tanzania. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Media reports indicate the Tanzanian government is ready to start deporting refugees to Burundi on Thursday. This is in line with a bilateral agreement the country signed in August to send the refugees home by the end of the year. The UN Refugee Agency says it is following these reports with worry and concern. UNHCR spokesman Barbara Balash tells VOA his agency hopes Tanzania and Burundi will not pressure or push refugees who fled persecution.
Many refugees and asylum seekers who have even recently arrived in Tanzania have cited persecution and fear of human rights abuses as the reason for their entry into Tanzania. So we hope that Tanzania will not put refugee lives at risk by putting pressure on them to return back home.
In 2015, Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza triggered widespread protests when he declared his intention to run for a third term. Government persecution and human rights abuses against opponents caused more than 340,000 people to flee to neighboring countries in search of refuge. Around 200,000 are in Tanzania. The UNHCR, Tanzania, and Burundi signed a tripartite agreement in March 2018 to facilitate the voluntary return of refugees to Burundi. Baller says the UNHCR hopes both countries live up to this agreement and ensure that all returns are voluntary and conducted in safety.
Hundreds of refugees still continue to flee Burundi. For us as UNHCR, the conditions are not conducive at this point to promote refugee returns in mass. More than 5,000 refugees have fled this year as well.
Over the past 2 years, more than 74,000 refugees have returned to Burundi, reportedly because of bad conditions in the camps and pressure from the Tanzanian government. Last month, the UN Commission of Inquiry on Burundi reported that serious human rights violations, including crimes against humanity, continued across the country. The three-member panel said the targets were real and suspected opposition supporters, including Burundians who have returned from abroad and human rights defenders. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. North Korea agrees to hold talks but then launches a projectile. UK's prime minister will unveil his Brexit offer to the European Union. The ex-military Israeli military chief Benny Gantz cancels power-sharing talks with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And Hurricane Lorenzo will bring 70-foot waves to the Azores. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, there was a major escalation in violence in Hong Kong Tuesday as police shot a protester at close range in the chest. Protesters threw gasoline bombs and police fired tear gas. Tens of thousands joined anti-government demonstrations that spread across the semi-autonomous Chinese territory, even as communist leaders in Beijing celebrated 70 years in power. My colleague Steve Miller talked about it with VOA correspondent Brian Padden in Hong Kong about what we know.
It's unclear the context of what happened. There is a report, and that video footage has confirmed the report that a protester was shot in the chest by police firing live rounds. This would be the first time that there was this type of report that the police in Hong Kong have been using live bullets to disperse or discourage or confront the protesters here. Up until now, there has been non-lethal force, but it's been escalating over the almost 4 months that this protest movement has been in operation. There have been more recently reports of police using water cannons, pepper spray, tear gas, rubber bullets. This was the first time that we've heard about live rounds.
There was some statements put out by authorities that they expected more violent clashes during this October 1st protests. What can you tell us about what you saw throughout the day during the October 1st events?
Well, it actually started off quite peaceful. The police had banned all protests and demonstrations today. But in defiance of that ban, political parties, democracy groups had vowed to take to the streets. And there was a major march, thousands of people marching through central Hong Kong today. And that, for the most part, went off peacefully. There were some side groups early on reported that were broken up by police or arrests, or there was tear gas used on one group. But for those of us who are in the central part of Hong Kong, you could just see the flow of people coming by, holding umbrellas, very peaceful, seemed to be tolerated by the police. And then as the afternoon went on, we saw more and more reports of police and protesters clashing. There were some reports of protesters throwing petrol bombs or confronting with the police itself, engaging with the police, and then numerous reports of police using tear gas and pepper spray and even water cannon against the protesters, and now this one report of live rounds being used. There have been concerns over the last recent weeks that police officials have been increasingly using terms like terrorists and extremists to describe the protesters, and that they need to be treated as such.
You mentioned that we're going on 4 months of continual protests. This all started with that extradition bill that has since been pulled. Have the residents in Hong Kong expressed any kind of fatigue to you since you've been there?
There have been some who are expressing fatigue, but what we saw, thousands and thousands more are still coming out to try to maintain the level of civil liberties that they have enjoyed here since the handover in 1997.
Brian Padden reports for VOA. He's currently in Hong Kong. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, 1 year after the murder of Washington Post columnist and U.S. resident Jamal Khashoggi, President Donald Trump remains a reliable ally of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, saying the relationship is special between the two countries and is bigger than any one issue. But many in the U.S. Congress are still pressing for changes in U.S. policy towards Saudi Arabia until those responsible for the murder are held accountable. VOA didiplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Jamal Khashoggi was killed and dismembered after he entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul by a Saudi team suspected to be acting on orders of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. 1 year later, his murder is being marked around the world with somber events, like this one last week in Washington, where 11 members of Congress took part. Since his death, the U.S. Congress has repeatedly clashed with President Donald Trump, voting to restrict U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia and to end U.S. military operations in the Saudi-led war in Yemen. Democratic Congressman Jim McGovern told VOA the president refuses to hold bin Salman accountable.
The bottom line is we should not be selling them weapons or providing them military assistance. That ought to be the consequence. And you see a bipartisan majority in the House and Senate that have been sending the president bills to limit certain weapon sales. The president has been vetoing these things.
Trump and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo have not wavered in their support for the Saudi royal family. The president has cited economic concerns for not damaging ties with Riyadh.
It's a very simple equation for me. I'm about make America great again, and I'm about America first.
I think Secretary Pompeo and President Trump have made their calculations with respect to Saudi Arabia, and so I think that is what we're seeing play out right now. We have a Saudi Arabia that has been very actively engaged in a conflict in Yemen, pretty much on a blank check from the United States.
Trump's personalization of U.S.-Saudi ties has not been helpful in dealing with the Khashoggi murder. Middle East expert Yasmin Farouk told VOA.
But the end result of it is that a strategic relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia today really hinges on the personal decision of the President of the United States more than it hinges on an institutional assessment of the importance of this relationship for the U.S. national security interest and for the U.S. strategic interests in the Middle East.
As Saudi Arabia tries to open up to tourism and international investment, Farouk says the Khashoggi murder will taint the kingdom for many years to come. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
VOA's International Edition continues. An international opera star known for her soprano tones has died. France 24 Public Broadcasting has this report.
Draped in a French flag, she sang the Marseillaise. At the bicentennial of the French Revolution in 1989. Revered worldwide, an opera legend, Jessie Norman passed away Monday at the age of 74. Her towering soprano voice, once called a velvet wonder and a grand mansion of sound, wowed generations in her long acclaimed career. Born in segregationist Georgia in 1945, she began singing gospel at age 4, and then received a full scholarship to study music at Howard University. Her star rose in Europe with her opera debut in Berlin in 1969. She would then go on to wow audiences worldwide with performances at the Metropolitan Opera, a memorial for 9/11 victims, and two presidential inaugurations. At age 52, Jessie Norman was the youngest person to ever receive a Kennedy Center honor. A multi-Grammy Award winner, she also received the French Légion d'Honneur. She was one of the first African-American women to rise to fame in the classical music world. And she had a voice that, as Toni Morrison once said, could break your heart, but also heal your soul.
All right. Well, Jessie Norman died from complications of a spinal cord injury. She was 74. That does it for our show today. Thank you for joining us on International Edition. Thanks to Director Tracy Carter and Engineer Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.